Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today we're exploring some really fascinating ancient settlements, mainly in the Afrin region of northern Syria, looking at the research picture up to about 2010.
That's right. These are the places often called the ancient villages of northern Syria. You might know them from the UNESCO listing.
Or sometimes the dead cities, which sounds dramatic. But it's because they were so well preserved after being abandoned for centuries.
Exactly. And it's important to remember, these weren't huge metropolises. They were mostly, you know, agricultural villages.
So they give us this amazing window into rural life, specifically in late antiquity and the Byzantine era, say roughly 1st to 7th centuries AD.
Precisely. So our focus today is really on understanding them based on that pre-2010 knowledge. Their environment, how they grew, why they declined.
And the incredible stone ruins they left behind. It's like a snapshot of history.
It really is. And the landscape itself is, well, quite distinctive. We're talking mainly about the limestone uplands in northwestern Syria.
Belus was it called in antiquity? Areas like Jebel Semen.
That's the one. And that gray limestone. It's everywhere.
Not just the ground, but their building material, right?
Absolutely fundamental. They built almost everything out of it.
And the environment. It looks tough now, but it supported farming, olives especially.
Yes, olives were key. But water management must have been absolutely critical.
Yeah, it makes you wonder. There's that theory, isn't there, that maybe it was more fertile back then, more topsoil, maybe more trees?
That's a really important point. It could mean the initial settlers didn't face quite the same challenges we might assume looking at it today. Resource availability would have shaped where they settled, surely.
Okay, so when did things really get going there? When did these villages start popping up?
The first signs are around the 1st century AD. Seems like it started with wealthy landowners building villas, mostly for olive cultivation.
But the main boom period was later, 4th to 6th centuries, under the Byzantines.
Exactly. That's when you see a real surge in construction. Lots of churches being built then.
What drove that expansion, do we think? Was it just the olive trade booming?
That was likely a huge part of it. Prosperity linked to the wider Byzantine economy.
But then things change. The decline starts, what, 8th to 10th centuries?
Yeah, somewhere in that time frame. And it wasn't like a switch being flipped, more of a gradual fading out over centuries.
And there were some big disruptions, weren't there? Those Persian-Byzantine wars in the early 600s must have hit hard.
Definitely destabilizing.
Yeah.
But then you also have the Arab conquests later in the 7th century.
Ah, right. That would have completely changed the political map and the trade routes, too.
Precisely. The olive oil trade, especially with big cities like Antioch and Apamea, got seriously disrupted.
And if olives were their main thing, that's a major blow.
A huge blow. There might have been other factors, too. Maybe epidemics, possibly some Christian emigration over time. We don't have all the answers there.
But the way they were abandoned relatively peacefully, that's why they're so well preserved.
That seems to be the case. No major later settlements built right on top. Not a lot of stone robbing for other projects for a long time. It left this incredible archaeological record.
Almost like time capsules. But you mentioned a concern even before 2010, something about resettlement.
Yes. There was a noticeable trend of modern agricultural resettlement starting to happen in those limestone areas.
Which sounds okay on the surface, but potentially threaten the ancient sites.
Exactly. Risk to the ruins themselves and the wider archaeological landscape around them.
Let's circle back to the olives. That economy was really the engine, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You find olive presses everywhere in these villages. It wasn't just local use. They were exporting olive oil across the Mediterranean. Big business.
And they clearly knew what they were doing. You mentioned water management, organized fields. This wasn't primitive farming.
No. Quite sophisticated for the time. They understood their environment.
But there's always a but.
Well, yeah. Relying so heavily on one thing that olive monoculture made them vulnerable.
Right. When those external shocks came, the wars, the changing trade routes, political shifts, their whole economic model was at risk.
It's a classic historical lesson, really.
It is. And alongside this economic story, there's a massive religious shift happening, too.
Yes, the change from Roman paganism to Byzantine Christianity. You can literally see it in the building.
It's written in stone, almost. Pagan temples gradually fade or are replaced, and suddenly you see churches, chapels, monasteries popping up everywhere.
And Christian symbols become really common. Crosses, the shiro.
All over the place.
Oops.
On lintels, capitals, it shows how deeply Christianity became part of the community fabric. They invested a lot in religious buildings.
Suggest it wasn't just imposed from the top down, right? It seems like these rural communities really embraced it.
That's the impression. And you have figures like St. Simeon's Stylites nearby. His sanctuary was a huge pilgrimage site. That must have had an influence.
So these villages weren't just quiet backwaters. They were active centers of Christian culture themselves, definitely. They weren't just passively receiving ideas from cities like Antioch. They were part of the development.
Okay, let's zoom in on a few specific sites. Based on what was known before 2010, Barad, or Brad, sounds like a major one.
It was one of the largest. By the 5th, 6th centuries AD, it was an important administrative center. But it started earlier, 2nd, 3rd century, as an agricultural place.
And it has some really significant buildings. The Julianos Cathedral, late 4th century.
Yes, a big basilica. There's speculation it might be on the site of an older Roman temple. And it had that Syrian bema, the raised platform.
Plus another church, the North Church, from the 6th century. A monastery, even a Roman-era bathhouse. It sounds quite developed.
It does. Warehouses, maybe a meeting house, tombs, and that Tetrapolon grave monument from the earlier Roman period.
And the connection to St. Maron being his reputed burial site. That must have made it a really significant pilgrimage spot for Maronite Christians.
Undoubtedly. A very important layer of its history.
Okay, what about Cyrus? Nibihuri or Quirosh? That one goes back even further, right? Seleucid times.
Yes. Much older foundation. Around 300 BC. Strategically located on the Afrin River. Mm. It was a big deal under the Romans to military base, commercial hub.
Justinian fortified it, so it remained important.
It did, and the ruins reflect that long history. You've got Roman bridges, a massive Roman theater.
Second largest in Syria, you said. Wow.
Yeah, impressive. And fortifications from different eras, Hellenistic, Roman, Byzantine, Islamic, layers upon layers.
And religiously complex, too. A big basilica, Hagiopolis, linked to Saints Cosmas and Damian. A pilgrimage site again.
Right. And maybe a Roman temple reused as a church. Then there's the Nebihuri Mausoleum. A Roman tomb later incorporated into a mosque.
That really shows the continuity, doesn't it? Different faiths reusing sacred or significant spots.
It does. And they found a Roman house there, too, with mosaics from the 2nd or 3rd century AD. That was a key discovery.
But Sears also faced problems before 2010. Looting, issues with maintenance.
Sadly, yes. There was looting reported in 2008, which led to the World Monuments Fund stepping in to help protect the Roman house. But general upkeep was a concern back then.
Okay, another site. Karab Shams. The sun ruins.
That's the translation, yeah. In the Jebel Simeon area, flourishing 4th, 6th centuries AD. The name probably comes from sun disk engravings found there.
What's the standout feature at Karab Shams?
Definitely the 4th century basilica. Around 372 AD, it's remarkably well-preserved, one of the oldest known in the whole Levant. They call it the Stilts Church because of its high arcades.
And evidence of earlier occupation, too. A pagan temple from the 3rd century.
Exactly. So you see that transition again. Pagan site. Then major Christian building. There's also a smaller 6th century church, villas, houses, an olive press. The typical elements.
So several researchers worked there over the years. Butler, Chilenko, and others. More recently, before 2010.
Yes, building on each other's work. Documenting the structures. Trying to understand the layout and history.
And quickly, the Fafritan Church. Significant because it's so early.
Extremely significant for that reason. In Jebel Semen, historically a Kurdish area, it has an inscription dating it to 372 AD.
Wow, same year as the Karab Shams Basilica. So really early evidence of church building.
Absolutely. Even though pre-2010 only the apse and some wall sections were standing, Howard Crosby Butler's plans from 1905 showed it was originally quite substantial, a 7-bay nave.
That cluster of early churches, Farfratin, Karab Shams, Julianus Cathedral at Barad, it really hammers home how important this region was for early Christianity and its architecture, doesn't it?
It really does. A major center of development, not some peripheral area.
So if we look at the architecture across all these sites, based on that pre-2010 research, what are the common threads? Limestone, obviously.
Limestone is king, yes. And church architecture dominates what survives. The basilica form is very common, single or three aisles.
Features like apses, narthexes, and that Syrian bema you mentioned.
Right, that raised platform is a key regional characteristic. And monasteries were complex structures, church, cells, maybe a hostel for pilgrims.
The construction itself sounds pretty solid. Ashlar masonry, those well-cut stones.
Very robust. The decoration maybe isn't as elaborate as in some other parts of the Byzantine world, but it's skillful. Carved lintels, capitals, different styles, some local adaptations, friezes, cornices.
And lots of Christian symbols worked in.
Everywhere. And researchers like Christine Strube really studied this decoration, showing how a distinct regional Syrian Byzantine style developed. It shows local creativity, not just copying.
What about non-religious buildings?
Well, we see those too. Villas for the wealthier residents, public bathhouses, those meeting houses or cafes, archaeologists sometimes call them warehouses.
And the practical stuff? Olive presses, cisterns for water, field walls, signs of a functioning, prosperous rural society.
Definitely. It's just a degree of social stratification, too. Not everyone lived in the same type of house.
And their tombs, stone tombs, mausolea.
Sarcophagi sometimes. Mm. And those unique tetrapylons, the four-arched grave monuments like the one at Barad.
Any evidence of other arts? Painting, mosaics.
Primarily, stone carving survives best. But yes, mosaics and traces of wall painting have been found, especially at richer sites like Cyrus.
Ooh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roach Bosch Hannah.
Ah, perfect timing.
Let's see, this chai. It's got a good, strong flavor, but it's a little on the bitter side today.
Is it? Let me try mine. Yeah, maybe a touch.
Definitely needs a touch more sugar to balance it out. That's much better. A little sweetness makes all the difference.
Mm-hmm. Much improved.
Right, where were we? Ah, yes, the exploration history. How did we even come to know about these places before 2010?
Well, it goes back quite a way. The Marquis de Voghi did important early documentation in the 19th century, bringing them to wider attention.
But the really foundational work was early 20th century, Howard Crosby Butler.
Absolutely. His surveys between 1899 and 1909 were incredibly extensive. He drew detailed plans, wrote descriptions. His work is still indispensable.
And then George Strelenko in the mid-20th century, his focus was more socioeconomic, the olive theory.
Yes. His massive study, Villages Antiques de la Syrie du Nord, provided fantastic site plans, but also pushed that theory about the olive monoculture being key to their rise and fall. Very influential work.
So those early figures laid the groundwork. What happened later, closer to 2010?
Things became perhaps more focused. Specific excavations rather than just broad surveys. Collaborative projects like the French mission and later the Syrian-Lebanese mission at Cyrus.
And scholars focusing on specific aspects like domestic architecture or the decoration.
Exactly. People like Tate on houses, Struve on decoration, guidebooks by Burns helping synthesize information, and importantly, a growing awareness of conservation needs.
Right. So what was the state of preservation like around 2010? Generally good, you said.
Exceptionally good overall, mainly thanks to that long period of abandonment. The lack of later building or stone reuse was key.
But not without threats.
No, definitely concerned. Natural decay, obviously. Yeah. But also modern encroachment. Sometimes people reusing old stones for new buildings.
Yeah.
And the agricultural resettlement we talked about.
And looting, unfortunately, like at Cyrus in 2008.
Yes. That was a serious incident. Mm. But it also spurred action.
Like the conservation efforts. The UNESCO nomination was underway then.
It was. The process leading to the 2011 inscription was already in motion. And you had organizations like the World Monuments Fund getting involved, helping protect the Roman house at Cyrus after the looting.
Were there plans for things like archaeological parks?
Yes. Around 2010, there was talk and some initial planning for developing archaeological parks and management centers to better protect and present the sites.
So wrapping up our look at these ancient villages based on the pre-2010 picture, it really is a remarkable story. A thriving rural society heavily based on olives, deeply Christian, leaving behind this incredible architecture.
It truly is. The research done up to that point gives us such a crucial foundation for understanding these places. It highlights their uniqueness and the importance of documenting and protecting them.
And it also, you know, left a lot of questions unanswered, didn't it? About daily life, specific trade connections, the nuances of how their society worked. Lots still to learn.
Always more to learn. But I think the key takeaway is that these weren't static dead cities. They were dynamic places shaped by powerful economic forces, profound religious beliefs, and constant interaction with the wider world around them.
So a final thought for you, our listener. Thinking about these villages reliant on their environment and a specific economy, transformed by cultural shifts. What is their story, their eventual decline? Maybe tell us about the challenges communities face even today, about sustainability, adaptation, and the long-term effects of big economic and cultural changes. Something to ponder.